You're listening to the DolphinsTalk.com podcast network. Welcome to Dolphins Talk Weekly, your one-stop audio breakdown of all of this week's Miami Dolphins news. Now, here is your host, Kevin Durr.
Good morning, Dolphins, and welcome to episode 19 of Dolphins Talk Weekly. I am your host, Kevin Dern. Happy Friday to you all as I sit and record this podcast. Give me a follow on Twitter at KevinMD4. You can follow along with the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, or wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. Please leave me a rating and review, and with the doldrums of summer nearly upon us, it's a great time to get questions into my Twitter handle for topics to discuss on upcoming X's and O's segments. Now, this week's episode is going to be a little bit different than what we've done in the past few weeks. And we're going to cover some of the, I won't call it news, but rumors that have been kind of tied to the Dolphins and several free agents that are still out there. And these rumors have sort of persisted post-draft, really. So since the draft, Miami's been linked to a few names. And we'll go into those thoughts briefly on, you know, who those guys are and what their potential fit in Miami would be, if anything. And then I want to do sort of a podcast within the podcast. I mentioned this in the past two episodes, but I'm currently working on an article for DolphinsTalk.com, and it's really kind of a unique look into what Miami has to do in order to catch the Buffalo Bills. And we'll dive into that discussion in a little bit and sort of the impetus behind why I wanted to put that piece together. And we'll go into that in more detail over this episode and maybe two or three subsequent episodes, because it's just too big to kind of break down the whole thesis of the article to put into one podcast. We'd be here for over an hour, and I know I already go long enough as it is. So we're going to dive into the free agent rumor news after a word from our sponsor, Manscaped.com. Guys, it's summer. The weather's here. If you live in the Midwest like me, you are inundated with the cicadas. At least give them something good to look at before they all die and disappear for another 17 years. Keep your yard looking great. Keep your own personal yard looking great with help from our friends at Manscaped.com. Use the promo code DolphinsTalk, and you can get up to 20% of your purchases at Manscaped.com off, and that includes free shipping. So Manscaped.com, promo code DolphinsTalk, up to 20% off. Keep your yard and your own personal yard looking great, not only for the cicadas, but for your lady this summer. Now, I digress from the ads, but we're going to go into some talk about some free agent names that have been linked to the Dolphins. And I've seen these, you know, I won't call them reports, but seen information about these names pop up on Twitter. And there's really three of them, all defensive players, that have sort of been circulating, you know, since the draft happened. Now, we talked about two of them on previous episodes, Malik Hooker and Melvin Ingram. And then there's been a third, while I haven't seen anything concrete that this player has been in contact or visited the Dolphins. That player is KJ Wright, the former Seattle Seahawks linebacker. Now, I think it's interesting that Miami's linked to those guys, because we talked about this on the podcast, you know, really leading up to the draft and since the draft, that I think that their defensive roster is about as loaded as you can get it for what they want to do and the things that they're going to try and add to the defense this year. You know, we talked about it last week, how you saw in some of the Dolphins draft videos that behind Chris Greer and Brian Flores was a depth chart listed on a whiteboard with the magnets, and it basically showed them having a four-man defensive front. And I've talked about that multiple times in the past, about how that's something I thought Miami would do. And I think for incorporating those changes, their depth chart on defense is pretty well set up. Maybe there's a couple spots here and there where you can tweak, you know, some of the depth. Now, as far as these free agents go, let's tackle them one at a time, and we'll do it kind of quickly because we've talked about Melvin Ingram on the show before, I think 2 weeks in a row now. with Malik Hooker, I think that ship has kind of sailed. You know, he's a really good player when he's been able to stay on the field. And I think he's certainly damn good enough to be a starter in this league. I think for him, it's more about finding an opportunity if he's patient. You know, Miami has effectively replaced Bobby McCain. They drafted Javon Holland, and then they signed Jason McCourty after Malik Hooker's visit. And to me, that sort of signifies that, you know, the opportunity just to be a starter wasn't going to be readily available for Malik Hooker in Miami. You know, we've seen, by and large, at pretty much every position other than quarterback, you know, because Miami had Ryan Fitzpatrick, that they're going to play younger guys when they're ready versus a veteran. And I think they're going to do everything in their power to get Javon Holland to be the starter week one, you know, barring any kind of injury or something like that. And they already now have an experienced player in Jason McCourty, who's been in this defense before during his time in New England, that can kind of, you know, be that set of veteran guardrails for him, be that sounding board when he has questions and help him out. So I think they've got that position fairly covered at this point. I don't see Malik Hooker signing here. I think the best move for him is to kind of wait it out and see if there's an opportunity to start that comes available, you know, closer to training camp or during camp in the preseason schedule. The second name was the new name to the list. I've only seen this reported by an NFL Rumors Twitter account, which, you know, doing some research, seems to be sort of a dubious account. And there's multiple of those out there on Twitter, as I'm sure all of you guys know. But as far as KJ Wright being linked to the Dolphins, as of this recording, which is Friday, June 4th, when I'm sitting down to do this, I have not seen a single thing about him being linked to the Dolphins in terms of having spoken to them and certainly not having come in and done a visit or some kind of Zoom visit with the team. Now, what would KJ Wright's fit in Miami be if there's, you know, if this thing gets legs and ends up turning into something? He's always been a part of the Seattle Pete Carroll under scheme. He's been a Sam linebacker in that scheme. He's been a Will linebacker in that scheme. He's got pretty good size, 6'4", 246 pounds, and was a pretty good athlete. He's been able to run throughout his entire career, and he's done some unique things in terms of coverage. Now, obviously, I think his most athletic days are a little behind him at this point. And he's never really had to be that edge-setting guy. So I don't really see him as a true fit as an outside linebacker in this scheme. Miami brought over Bernardrick McKinney in the Shaq Lawson trade. Brian Flores talked about his role being very multiple. And it, to me, that kind of smells like he's going to replace Kyle Van Noy in at least some of the capacities Van Noy was used in last year. So I don't know that KJ Wright would be an effective edge setter. Miami already has a couple linebackers that can run and can cover. You know, Jerome Baker, if you don't remember what I'm talking about here, go back and watch Miami's game against San Francisco. Look at what he did to George Kittle in that game. I know Eric Rowe gets a lot of the plaudits for covering tight ends, and he did some against Kittle in that game, but watch what Jerome Baker did and you'll see why. You know, he's a vital piece of this defense. And then they brought in Duke Riley in free agency on top of it. KJ Wright, not really a pass rusher. I don't think he's recorded a sack in the past two seasons. Always been kind of more of a blitzer. Miami's got guys who can do that. You know, Jerome Baker got, what, 7 sacks a year ago, basically being that. So I don't really see him as a fit as an inside off-ball linebacker because you have Jerome Baker, you brought back Elandon Roberts. Bernardrick McKinney's probably going to play a healthy amount of snaps as both an on-the-line edge linebacker and as an off-ball linebacker. It just doesn't seem like a great fit to me. Finally, Melvin Ingram, who did come in for a visit and has been working out in Miami with Xavien Howard, if you followed Xavien Howard's social media. No news as of yet in terms of him signing with the Dolphins. There's been a couple reports that he's leaning towards trying to get a deal done to return to the Los Angeles Chargers. He's the one guy that I think would actually have a 200 to 300 snap role. I talked about it on last week's show, so we won't dive into it, but essentially that role would be in their third down package is someone who can rush over guards, and I think he would prove to be better depth as a stand-up rusher than Brennan Scarlett and Vince Beagle. You know, I don't think Melvin Ingram would be a true defensive end in this system, you know, given that they've asked guys like Emmanuel Ogba and Shaq Lawson last year to reduce inside and play 3-4-I and 4 techniques at times. That's not really Melvin Ingram's game unless it's in a true pass rushing situation. So, you know, overall, Melvin Ingram would be the guy that I would want at this point out of the three of them. But it seems unlikely to me that Miami is going to be able to offer any of those guys an opportunity to become a starter, just given what they have on defense already. I think they've assembled a pretty good roster. So I think those guys, those three veterans, are better served by being patient and looking for opportunities to start. Now, that's not to say Miami won't make any moves. You know, Chris Greer loves to trade. You know, people have pointed to his article, the article that Peter King did in Football Morning in America with Greer and Flores. And Chris Greer made 28 trades in his first 28 months on the job. You know, that's a trade a month. Last year, leading up to training camp, he made the trade with Chicago for tight end Adam Shaheen. And during camp, he traded Raekwon McMillan to the Raiders. And then a couple days later, made another trade with the Raiders and brought Lynn Bowden from Las Vegas to Miami. So clearly, Chris Greer is not afraid to kind of shuffle the bottom of the roster and make moves where he sees fit and sees it as being advantageous for the team. I think there's certainly opportunities to upgrade some depth spots on this roster, and maybe the depth at that outside linebacker position behind Andrew Van Ginkle and Bernardrick McKinney is one of those areas. But I just have a hard time seeing any move get done right now. Now, the meat of our podcast is going to be dedicated to this series about what does Miami have to do to catch the Buffalo Bills. And I guess just to give you some context here, I'm old enough to remember having seen Dan Marino play and still play at a high level. You know, I'm talking about before the last 2 or 3 years under Jimmy Johnson, where Miami would make the playoffs and then got, you know, shellacked by the Raiders, shellacked by Denver. You know, I'm talking about the early to mid-90s up until Don Shula's retirement. And seemingly every opportunity that Miami and Dan Marino specifically had to make a run in the playoffs and get Dan Marino back to another Super Bowl always ended up being thwarted by the Buffalo Bills. And growing up as a kid, you know, this is in elementary school and middle school, I could not stand the Bills. Jim Kelly, Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed, Cornelius Bennett, Steve Tasker, Steve Christie. Couldn't stand all of them. And, you know, in my adult life, I actually have had the opportunity to meet Jim Kelly twice. You will not find a nicer, funnier, more genuine human being. You know, he's an absolute gem of a person. And, you know, nothing but best wishes for Jim Kelly and all those guys, really, and they're in retirement. But when they played, I could not stand Buffalo. And now that the Bills are seemingly back, you know, the last 2 years, they went from losing in Houston in the wild card round and kind of a weird game to losing in the AFC Championship game to Kansas City last year. That's a pretty dramatic improvement they've made. And they were not afraid to kind of tear down that roster after they made the playoffs in 2017 with Tyrod Taylor at quarterback and rebuild and become something even better. So what I wanted to look at was what does Miami have to do to catch them? Because if we look at the landscape of the AFC East right now, the Jets are going through the process that Miami started 2 years ago where they've basically hit the entire reset button. They've gotten their quarterback, new coach, a lot of new players in place, new general manager and Joe Douglas. We don't really know yet how good or not the Jets will be. You know, they are clearly the fourth team out of four at this point in the AFC East. New England obviously doesn't have Tom Brady anymore. had a rough year last year and have added a ton of new pieces. That doesn't always spell a recipe for success. And let's face some hard truths here for the Patriots. They don't really have a proven quarterback at this point. You know, Cam Newton, ever since the shoulder injury, hasn't been the same throwing the football. Mac Jones, sort of that one and a quarter year wonder, and ends up being a first round pick. We don't know what that's going to be like. So I think really right now on paper, Miami is clearly team number two in the AFC East behind Buffalo. Now, I hate to bring it up again, but the last 2 years under Brian Flores, the Dolphins are 0-4 against the Bills. So what do we have to do to catch them? And I've been working on a piece for DolphinsTalk.com, and it's really kind of focused on three parts. You know, the first part, which is what we're going to talk about today on the podcast, was a look at statistically, where is Miami close, where are they better, where are they behind, and by how much are they behind Buffalo? And I think the numbers will surprise you guys a little bit. We'll go through those here in a second. The second part was going to be looking specifically at games the Bills lost last year. Now, those games are the miracle in Arizona when Kyler Murray threw the Hail Mary to DeAndre Hopkins. Not really a rough loss. I mean, rough in the way that it happened, but Buffalo was right there in that game. The other losses they had, they lost to Kansas City twice, once at home in the regular season and then once on the road in the AFC Championship game. And then they got absolutely blasted by the Tennessee Titans on the road. I think that was 42-16, 42-17, something like that. I wanted to take a look at those losses and see what those teams did differently compared it to Miami. And then the third part that I want to look at is related to the quarterbacks. You know, a lot of people like to denigrate Josh Allen, but he has played some of his best ball in the four games he's started against the Dolphins the past 2 years. Clearly, he's improved since his rookie year in the league, and I wanted to kind of look at the type of jump he made and see if we can expect Tua Tagovailoa to make a similar jump over the next year or even 2 years. So that'll be part three of the podcast. Now, I'm not going to read off every one of these offensive and defensive statistics, but I went through and I've got about 10 key stats on each side of the ball and kind of went through and went and looked at, you know, the rankings where Buffalo was in terms of the league and where Miami was in terms of the league average and where they may rank and what that margin of difference is. And I've sort of come up with one statistical conclusion, and it's this. And I'll go through this slowly because I can't think of a great way to word this without it sounding at least a little confusing. The conclusion that the statistics show me is such that Buffalo's offense is better than Miami's offense by a wider margin than Miami's defense is better than Buffalo's defense. And that was sort of surprising to me, considering how good the Dolphins' defense was up until week 17 when they got drubbed by said Buffalo Bills. But Buffalo's defense actually wasn't that far behind in a lot of major categories. And we'll go through those here in a second. I wanted to focus on, let's see, four key statistics on both sides of the ball. I won't read through every single number and stuff. I'll have this in the written article. You can check it out. I'll have an Excel table in there that you can look at and go through each statistic. But in terms of offense, the main statistics I wanted to look at here were points per game, points per drive, passing yards per attempt, and third down percentage. So going through and comparing Miami to Buffalo, these four categories are sort of where the biggest discrepancies lie in terms of Miami's offense being able to catch up to Buffalo's offense. So in points per game, Miami last year averaged 25.3, which is right around the middle of the pack in the NFL. They were 15th. It's basically a full touchdown behind where Buffalo was per game. Buffalo averaged 31.3 points per game, second in the league. And to me, that seemed pretty surprising. And I think some of that might be inflated due to the 56 points they put up on the Dolphins in Week 17. But even still, if that average came down a little bit, if you take that game out, Miami's still about a full touchdown behind where Buffalo needs to be. And when you put that into context, I believe Kyle Krabs had an article about this for Dolphins Wire, that last year, in terms of points per game scored, Miami had like the 10th best season in their franchise history. And you're still a full touchdown behind where Buffalo is. Now, to kind of break down that a little more, I wanted to look at points per drive. How efficient were teams? And Miami was ranked 15th in this category as well, averaging about 2.32 points per drive. You know, by and large, historically, over the past 3 or 4 years, the league average has been about 2.5 points per drive. So they were a little below that mark. But I think 2.5 is considered kind of that threshold where you start to have some of the better offenses. And if you can get up towards 3 points per drive, your offense is really efficient. Well, Buffalo was pushing that territory. They were third in the league last year at 2.93 points per drive. So about 0.6 points per drive away from Buffalo. So clearly there's an impetus on Miami to add more points. Now you can look through some of the volume stats in terms of total passing, total rushing, things like that. Miami's not terribly far away. One of the categories you look at is passing yards per attempt. How efficient is the passing game? Now, this is counting both Tua Tagovailoa and Ryan Fitzpatrick's numbers from last year. But Josh Allen and the Bills' offense were tied for fourth in the NFL in terms of yards per attempt passing, averaging 8.0 yards per attempt. That was a full yard higher than what Miami averaged. Miami was 23rd in the league, averaging 7 yards attempt, 7.0. Now, I didn't do the math. I didn't have time to do that in preparation for the podcast, but you would have to imagine if you take out Ryan Fitzpatrick's contributions to that number, Miami's number drops with Tua Tagovailoa. So that is something you have to get more efficient at, and we'll kind of go over that here in a second. And then the other major category, you know, giveaways. Miami was actually better than Buffalo in that category. Miami had 20. The Bills had 22. Sacks allowed weren't that much difference. You know, both teams were in the top half. Buffalo was 9th, Miami was 15th. Red zone percentage, Miami's fairly close to what Buffalo did. But third down conversion percentage, being able to extend drives, is a major sore spot for the Dolphins. They were 27th in the NFL last year. They converted 38.6 third down conversions. 38.6% on third downs. Not good. Buffalo, best in the NFL. Damn near 50% conversion success rate. 49.7%. So Miami was more than 10% worse than Buffalo in this category. And that's one area where you've got to close the gap. Now, let's look at the defensive side. The points per game margin, obviously Miami's kind of got skewed because of Week 17 giving up 56, and there were a handful of special teams touchdowns allowed during the year. Buffalo had one in that game. The Chiefs had one, a punt return for a touchdown. But Miami finished tied for 5th with New Orleans, allowing 21.1 points per game. Buffalo wasn't that far behind in terms of the actual number. They allowed 23.4, but that was only good for 15th in the league. So there's clearly a bunch of teams kind of all stacked up in that 21 to 23.5 points per game allowed range. So that's one area where you've got to get better in terms of Miami, and I think that one game kind of blew it out of proportion. Now, where Miami did a better job and this is kind of related to takeaways to some degree, was the number of score, the percentage of drives that ended in opponents' points. So your scoring drive per allowed percentage. Miami was fourth best in the league. They allowed points on just 30.7% of opponents' drives. So less than a third of the drives they had on defense ended up allowing points. Buffalo, a little below the league average, they gave up points on 39.4% of drives. That was 18th in the league. So Miami had a pretty nice advantage there. And if you can improve upon that and become one of the top two, maybe even the top team in that category, that's going to help your football team in terms of complementary efficiency. Takeaways and sacks. This one surprised me. Miami led the league in takeaways last year with 29. And I thought they would be, you know, pretty well ahead of Buffalo. And that's not the case. Buffalo was third in the NFL in takeaways with 26, only three behind. In terms of sacks, Miami was tied for 10th with 41. Buffalo was 14th with 38. So they were only three behind there, behind Miami. They've gone out and drafted Gregory Rousseau and Carlos Basham. So clearly Buffalo making a concerted effort to pressure quarterbacks more. And I guess you look at some of these other categories, and Miami really doesn't have a big advantage in a lot of them in terms of passing defense, you know, in terms of volume and in terms of yards per attempt. They're behind Buffalo considerably, despite having the league lead in takeaways and a very good secondary. And what these statistical categories kind of show me here is, coupled with what Miami did in the offseason, I think they were right on the money in terms of addressing these trends. So while we won't know if they close the gap until we see them play, and I guess week two is going to come up pretty quick, I think Miami's figured out what their weaknesses were, and they've at least made attempts to address those weaknesses. And that should get you very excited. You know, if some of these moves they make, if all of these moves they make pan out, I think they're going to start to reel in Buffalo, at least incrementally. I do apologize if you heard some noise there in the background. My co-host is our 70-pound pit lab named Chloe, who has decided to take up residence right next to my chair as I record this. So, good girl, Chloe. But looking at the off-season plans and what Miami did, you know, this one kind of ties into yards per passing attempt. They realized that Tua Tagovailoa, not the strongest arm, I think that was pretty well known coming out of Alabama, but you go out and you add Will Fuller and Jalen Waddle, two guys with speed who can increase that yards per attempt by accumulating yards after the catch. The other advantage that has is because you have two guys with speed, that frees you up to get more one-on-one attempts with Devontae Parker on the backside, who can use that 6'3" frame and go up and catch some jump balls. So you do have the ability to kind of push the ball down the field a little more into some of those one-on-one situations, which is what Ryan Fitzpatrick did so well for Miami. And I think we saw Tua start to attempt more of those throws as the season wore on, at least for him. So that's a category I think Miami has addressed, despite having the limited capability of Tua's downfield arm. Now, in terms of third down efficiency, look at what Miami did in the offseason. I think these are kind of subtle moves, but they signed Malcolm Brown from the Los Angeles Rams. And you don't really think of Malcolm Brown as a third down back. He's more of a short yardage specialist and power back, you know, out there to complement Cam Akers. But I did some digging in terms of his statistics, and he had 23 catches last year. Nine of those receptions went for first downs. So almost 40% of his receptions went for a first down. And I think if you watch some of him play, and you can even go back and look at my offensive free agents article, I highlighted his good hands and his ability to kind of make good decisions in space to accumulate more yardage. So I think that is a sneaky addition to Miami's third down offense is Malcolm Brown. Now, they kind of doubled down on that by drafting Jared Doakes, who from the University of Cincinnati, who's kind of the same. You know, he's a bigger back, a good pass protector with soft hands that you don't really expect to be part of a third down package. But I think both of those guys give you an upgrade to what you had last year when you were sort of rotating between Miles Gaskin, Jordan Howard for a time, and then Patrick Laird later in the season. They also, I think, made a pretty nifty draft move, the more and more I look at it, by taking Hunter Long, the tight end from Boston College, in the third round. I've watched a lot of his games over the past 2 weeks, and he's very good at getting himself open and making contested catches over the middle of the field. Despite Mike Gesicki's receiving prowess, he's done most of his damage either up the seam or outside. He's not the guy that's going to sit over the middle and find, you know, holes in the zone and sit down and make catches. So while they're not, you know, flashy, glitzy names, I think Malcolm Brown and Hunter Long are going to go a long way in terms of helping fix Miami's YPA in terms of passing and third down percentage. So Miami's offense, you know, fairly close in some categories. You can check that out in the article. But I like the fact that they've been able to kind of make those moves. And that should get you excited for the offense, as it provides Tua Tagovailoa with some easier outlets. You're not always having to try and force the ball down the field to your speed targets or Parker or Gesicki. You have some guys who can operate over the middle and guys who can operate underneath. Then you look at the defensive side of the ball. We talked about sacks, Miami being tied for 10th in the league with 41. They had the third highest blitz percentage in the league in terms of blitzing on 39% of opponents' passing snaps. And if you go back and you watch the Week 2 game against Buffalo, you watch the Week 4 game against Seattle, you watch the Kansas City game, one thing Miami struggled to do, and I think Barry Jackson mentioned this in a piece earlier this week, is that Miami's pass rush win rate was pretty dismal. I think it was second worst in the league. And outside of Emmanuel Ogba, who had a career season in 2020, Miami just wasn't able to generate consistent pressure when they rushed four or three guys. They had to rush five or more in order to get to opposing quarterbacks. So you look at the additions they've made there. Now, I think everyone knows the obvious one is they drafted Jalen Phillips from the University of Miami. Good pass rusher. I believe he had 8 sacks his final year in Miami. That gives you another bookend to place opposite Emmanuel Ogba when you want to rush four. Or as we talked about in the Odd Mac O episode, now you have 2 defensive ends that can be part of that system that can win one-on-ones by themselves. They don't necessarily need to be involved in all those games. I think the more subtle addition is Adam Butler, the defensive tackle who signed with the Dolphins as a free agent from New England this offseason. Again, I would encourage you to watch the Coach Voss videos on the Odd Mac O and look at all the different ways that Adam Butler is a part of that package. Now, he may not necessarily be getting sacks and winning a bunch of one-on-ones, but what he does to get other guys free runs at the quarterback is very valuable. You won't see it on a box score, but I would encourage you to watch it and kind of in your head piece together how this package is going to look in Miami. I think Adam Butler will be a very key part of it. Then you look at some of the other things that Miami has done. You know, in terms of rushing defense, Miami was middle of the pack in the league, 16th overall. Buffalo was right behind them. Buffalo only gave up like 3 more yards a game. They've made additions at every level of the defense. Bernardrick McKinney, in terms of the secondary, they definitely got more athletic with Javon Holland, Jason McCourty, Justin Coleman, all coming in as additions there that figure to factor in heavily. So in terms of part one, I think Miami has realized some of these statistical deficiencies in terms of catching up with the Buffalo Bills. And while we don't know if they've made any progress on that in terms of on-field success, I think it's key to recognize that they were able to recognize their own deficiencies through their own self-scouting and were not afraid to throw resources at it. You know, they could have just, you know, tendered Nick Needham and said, okay, you know, here's to hoping you get even better in year three. They didn't do that. You know, they went out and they drafted a guy who has experience in the slot in Javon Holland. They signed Justin Coleman, who's been a slot corner his entire NFL career. They've talked about, openly talked about this year, trying to trade Noah Igbinoghene to play in the slot. So they're trying to give themselves the best options they can to match up with a team like Buffalo. And I think it's especially important against Buffalo because Buffalo burned Miami on all those deep, long developing crossing routes last year. Miami had no answer for it. Now you've got more speed, more athleticism, and even a little bit more size in the secondary, at least on paper right now. That should help combat that. You've added some more pass rush up front, which could potentially help you get to Josh Allen more, help keep him in the pocket. You've added more size to help stop opponents' running games. So, to me, it's all very encouraging that Miami has taken these steps. And next week on the show, you know, we'll cover any news updates. I know Brian Flores spoke to the media today. I did not have access to it, so we will talk about what he said next week, if there's anything newsworthy. And we'll dive into part number two of this Catching Buffalo series, the podcast within a podcast. And we'll take a look at what teams did to beat the Bills last year and how Miami can replicate or even expand upon those strategies. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for reading all the articles. I hope to have the article about Catching Buffalo up on DolphinsTalk.com in the next week. I'm sorry it's taken me a little bit longer, but had some things going on outside of work in the podcast that have taken up some time, but we'll get back on track. Thank you guys for listening. Again, feel free to follow me on Twitter at KevinMD4. Would love to see questions about future X's and O's segments or anything you have on your mind about the Dolphins. Enjoy your weekend and fins up.